There are all different ways to keep the mind concentrating. And each of those particular different permutations of attention represent one of the factors of a concentrated mind. And that's really what I want to teach as the lesson tonight. So I want to back up a little bit. So I want to start this way. I want to start by saying that I think that the Buddha taught a very optimistic Dharma. I like to say that because I think actually the zeitgeist has changed over the 30 years that I've been practicing. When I began, people started immediately with the Four Noble Truths. And the context was the Buddha said, I came to do one thing and one thing only. I came to discover the cause of suffering and the end of suffering. And it's sort of leading with suffering. And when I read the texts and began to read scripture, I discovered that the Buddha was often called the happy one. When I began to teach classes, particularly at that time I was teaching at the college level, and I began to teach beginning Buddhism, and I would teach, start in with life is difficult, and we struggle so much that converts the difficulty into suffering. And I think that I remember especially young people were troubled by the emphasis on suffering. And at one point somebody said to me, do Buddhists have birthday parties? So I actually had to shift the pedagogy a little bit, because Buddhists have birthday parties and they celebrate births and weddings and good tidings and all of those things. But also I think, I don't know what it is, but over the years I hear myself and my colleagues shifting. We are still teaching the same truths about what causes suffering and what's the end of suffering. But we are starting more by talking about that the Buddha taught the possibility of happiness in this life. It's a difficult life for everybody. It's not as difficult for everybody in this room. We have much easier lives on a concrete level of day-to-day existence than practically all of the rest of the world. But everybody in the whole world has a mind, and everybody's mind creates difficulties. And in that way, we are all of us the same. And the mind that creates difficulties that involve agonizing is the mind that creates suffering. So what the Buddha really taught is that there must be a way to train the mind to see through that suffering and come to a place of clarity and a place of non-confusion. And in that place of non-confusion, he taught, what happens is that our natural wisdom manifests itself. Problems that we seem to not be able to deal with before, all of a sudden, we sit down for a while, we sit quietly, and all of a sudden it comes to us, that thing that I was worried about, that's not that complicated. I can do it this way or that way. Isn't it true for you that sometimes when you're sitting here, all of a sudden, unbidden, your mind tells you something, unties a knot for you. It says, I don't have to get so upset about that. I can do that this way or I can do that way. Doesn't that happen for you? And you didn't even say, it's not like you type into a computer and say, tell me the answer to my problem. But it's the same in some ways, sit down. There are other things that my mind tells me when I sit down, tells me when I made some mistakes. And it says, listen, you have a little bit of cleanup that you have to do. You didn't really talk long enough on the phone to this person, or you gave this person short shrift. I love it that my mind spontaneously does a moral inventory. But my mind does a moral... Well, mostly I love it. On the days that it does too much moral inventory, I get a little tired of it. Or I say, that's enough of the inventory for today, but I'll have more tomorrow. But mostly I feel very good about the moral inventory because it's spontaneous, and the fact that it happens to everybody really affirms for me the fact that I think we are basically kind beings. I think that human beings, not everybody, but as a species, I think we are congenial, convivial, companionable animals. We're herd animals. We like to stay together in groups. And we take care of each other. That really is our inclination. We have a caring instinct. I think that what happens is when my... I know that what happens for me, and I think it's true for you, that when my mind is clear, my natural wisdom presents itself, and also my good heart is available to me. I feel affectionate to the people that I care about in my life and know about, and often to the people that I don't know about, just because they're people, and just because I intuit on some level that they, like me, have a life full of challenges and difficulties. And we all got up this morning and put on our shoes and socks and came out. That's very heroic of all of us, especially on a day of challenging weather. We're really very heroic people. We keep getting up in the morning and trying once again to have a good day. And I feel as if what happens to our companionable animals when they're content is they relate to each other. I relate to other people, and I relate to myself in a way that's friendly, in a way that's affectionate, in a way that's appreciative, and a way that's compassionate when I'm in trouble. And I think my experience is that when my capacity to be in a warm relationship with myself or anyone else is alive, then I am happy. I feel not isolated, not frightened. I feel like I live in a world of people, and I am part of the this world unfolding. So really, when I talk about happiness being an inside job, the inside job is the returning of the mind to clarity every time it becomes confused. And it's incredibly easy to become confused. It's incredibly easy to become angry. I just thought of a two-minute event that happened to me sometime this year. It's amazing what the mind will do. I was sitting in a chair where I often sit in the morning to meditate in my house, sitting in a very comfortable chair, and the chair is right next to a window, and outside the window is a big old oak tree. And the oak tree has a crook in it and two big branches coming out right in front of where I'm sitting. So I sat for my meditation, and I opened my eyes. There, in the crook of the oak tree, apparently is, a squirrel hanging with its back quarters facing me and its front quarters over the other side of this notch in the oak tree. So all I can see is the hind quarters of what appears to be a dead squirrel. It is splayed out there in my oak tree. And its legs are splayed out, and its tail is hanging straight down, and it's completely inert. And I open my eyes, and I look at that. I have a terrible sinking feeling. The squirrel has died. And I bang on the window, squirrel, get up. And it stays there. I felt terrible. And bang a little bit more, squirrel, get up. It's hanging there. And at first I felt terrible for the squirrel. Then I started to think, I can't leave that squirrel hanging in the tree like that. It's really bad. I'm going to have to go get a ladder and go down. I'm at home alone. I'll have to go out and get a ladder and bring the ladder over to the oak tree and get up there and get down that dead squirrel. And then I'm feeling badly for myself that I'm going to have to go do that with the squirrel. And at that minute, the squirrel jumps up. And he or she, I was so happy, my heart leaped up, partly that the squirrel was alive, also that I didn't have to go get a dead squirrel out of the tree. And it ran down the branch of the oak tree, and it jumped down into my foolproof squirrel bird feeder and started to eat the bird food. And I was banging on the window and saying, squirrel, get out of the bird food. And I was mad. And that all happened in 2 minutes, less than 2 minutes probably. I went from disconsolate to sad to morose to depressed to delighted to furious, all in a very short period of time. The mind is completely volatile. It's So I laughed, you know. I said, the mind runs away with itself. And really, I knew that, you know, at the moment, I looked at it and I realized the folly of it. I also realized that if someone had told me a squirrel is coming, put out squirrel food, I would have put out squirrel food. Really, I'm happy that the squirrel is eating. But I put out bird food, and I expected birds, not squirrels. And it's ridiculous when you think about it. But actually, I heard the Dalai Lama say once when someone asked him if he ever got angry, he said, of course, things happen. It's not what you expect will happen. And anger arises. At that moment, he said, he's got this funny little laugh, you know, and then he said, but it doesn't have to be a problem. And really, the point is that everything arises and it doesn't have to be a problem. So I'll tell you another story, which will relate to the five different kinds of breathing exercises that we did. You may know that I teach a Wednesday morning class regularly for 15 years now at Spirit Rock. So it's a community that knows each other well, just as probably many of you know each other well. So on one particular morning, somebody said, you know, yesterday I had a terrible morning. I live in San Francisco. I went out to my car, and I went to put the car without an automatic key, because she said, I went to put my key in the door, and I noticed that the keyhole was lower than it normally is. And then I looked down and I saw that someone had come in the night and stolen all four tires, and that my car was sitting on the hubcaps. She said, I was so dismayed. I lived two blocks from Stonestown Shopping Center. I was so upset. I went over to Stonestown and I bought the silk pajamas that were in Nordstrom's window that I had been coveting. And then I went home and I went to my apartment and called the police. But somebody else said, you did that? I wouldn't have done that. I would have gone back into the apartment building. I would have found the super of the building. I would have given her a piece of my mind. You know, I pay rent here. People are supposed to be minding the street. Rather than that, could this happen? And then I would have gone to work, and I would have given everybody there a hard time, because after all, if I'm upset, I have a right to make everybody else upset. Somebody else said, you did that? I would have been so upset when I saw this, and I realized what I have to do. I have to call the cops. I have to make reports. I have to file papers. I have to call my insurance. I would have gone back into my apartment and I called my work and said, listen, I can't come to work today. I've had it. This has done me into the day. I'm already done in. You know, I got too much to do. I'll come tomorrow. So by this time, I think people weren't making this up, but they were starting to laugh because this is a pattern. Somebody else said, you all know me, you know, I would have gone out and said, today, the tires, tomorrow, the car. You know, I worry about everything. I catastrophize. I shouldn't be in this neighborhood. And then somebody else said, I wouldn't have done any of those things. I would have thought, once again, I made a stupid decision. I shouldn't have lived in this area. I should have known better than to rent an apartment in this area. These kind of things happen in this area. And if you've been around studying Dharma for a while, you probably know that the Buddha taught that the mind, when it gets upset and meets the challenge with one of five characteristic kinds of responses. Some people meet a response, their first response to a challenge, if their mind isn't balanced, and if they don't wait long enough to figure it out, is they find something to sensually soothe them. This is called in the text, it's called the lust types, which sounds bad, like a lust type. But, you know, it means someone who goes to Nordstrom's and buys a pair of silk pajamas, or goes back in the apartment and fixes a hot chocolate, or goes across the street to Starbucks and has a scone and a latte, or makes himself feel better in some physically, sensually pleasing way, pulls it together from that, and then goes about and does what they're supposed to do. You probably recognize the second type is what in the text is called the aversive type. They get angry easily. In a more general parlance, we call it the short fuse type. They get mad very easily. As I'm telling you this, you might want to think which type you are, by the way. So the short fuse type, you know, when in doubt, get angry, and it's someone else's fault. The third person who said, you know, I'd be done in, I'd go in and say, oh, I can't come to work today. I've had it. I'm too tired already from this. That in the text, in the modern times, we call it the mind without energy. But in the text, they're much more graphic. They call it sloth and torpor. That's, you know, you really get sloth and torpor. Some people's minds have sloth and torpor. One of my very best friends, who's a quite noted Dharma teacher, says that her principal hindrance, these are hindrance energies, her principal hindrance is sloth and torpor. And when we teach together, we always say, well, if we both got the same phone call that said, ring, ring, hello, I'm calling you from the south of France. I have rented a small chateau with 40 bedrooms for 10 days in April, and we're going to give a retreat here in Provence. And we'd like to fly you over to Aix-en-Provence to teach this retreat. And being the type of partly lust and partly restless type that I am, I would be packing my bag as I'm on the phone. And my friend would be thinking, south of France, such a long flight. And then you have to take the train from Paris. And the truth is that we would both go if it were at the right time and it was a good thing to teach. But what comes up in the mind first comes through the grid of everybody's functional grid. The fourth type is called restless mind, and it often manifests as worry mind. Several people in my family have it. I have it. It's the kind of mind that, given any small provocation, imagines the possibility of a catastrophe. It used to be when I'd make up with my husband when we traveled a lot all of our lives. I'd make up with him, especially in a foreign city, you know, this was more than ever. Make up, he'd say, I'll meet you at such and such a corner at 5 o'clock. And then you arrive and it's 5 minutes to 5. It's not even 5 yet. And he's not there. And you think to yourself, what if he's not here? What if he doesn't show up? What if he doesn't show up? And if he doesn't show up, do I have the passports? Does he have the passports? Where's the American embassy? What if he never shows up? What if he's actually dead in an alley? And I have to call my children and tell them that. How would I break the news to them? And then he comes around the corner and he's there. But, you know, I'm the kind of person that when you're in an airport and they say, ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? I think, something crashed. And they're just going to say, please keep your personal luggage under your surveillance. Anybody here has minds like that? Yeah, a lot of people have their hands up, you know. That actually, no, you know, a lot of people put up their hands. You know, the worst is the ski bus. The ski bus is coming home from a Saturday of skiing, and you are at 9 o'clock in the parking lot of the shopping center waiting for the ski bus, and it's supposed to be there at 9, and it's 9:05. The ski bus isn't there. It's 9:10, and it's raining. So anybody who's a good mother thinks to themselves, it's raining here. The bus is late, and it's raining here. That can only mean one thing. It's snowing in the mountains and the bus is in a ravine. And then somebody says, it's raining. Why don't we step into the coffee shop and have coffee? And you think, what kind of a parent could be having? Am I the only person who has that? Do you recognize? How many people recognize that kind of feeling? There you go. A lot of people recognize that. It's called catastrophic thinking, and it's the mind with a lot of energy in it, and it imagines everything all the time. So that's the fourth type. The fifth type is the type that said, the fifth type of hindrance in the Buddhist lexicon of hindrances is a hindrance called the hindrance of doubt, and it's called wobbly mind, the mind that wobbles. And it's never quite sure of itself. Ah, it was my mistake. I shouldn't have moved here. I should have done something else. I shouldn't have a relationship with this person. Maybe the other person. It's the wrong person in my relationship. This is the wrong practice. This is maybe the right practice, but the wrong teacher. And it's the wrong retreat at the wrong time, and I chose it. It's my fault, because I chose it. And it's just wobbly mind, but some people do that. Maybe the Libras. My father was a quintessential Libra. He said, I think we should do it this way for this, this, and this reason. I said, that sounds like a good plan, Dad. Let's do it. He said, but on the other hand, we could do it this way. This other plan, B, is this, we could do it that way. I said, well, Dad, that sounds good. Let's do it that way. He said, but on the other hand, this. And that is wobbly mind, not sure of itself. Those five practices that we did were practices that were built as counteractives to those five hindrances. They're called the factors of concentration. When we did the first one, we did, as you're sitting, look for the tiniest parts of the breath, the space between here and there, the very moment that a new breath begins. The looking at a small part of a global experience really wakes up the mind, like you have to pay attention. Someone said there's a grain of rice that fell on this floor. The first person who finds it gets a prize. We'd really be looking. So the mind that's really looking wakes itself up. So the mind that's filled with sloth and torpor, if it looks for something closer, the person with sloth and torpor, if you could look at a smaller incremental part, especially in meditation, it's an important thing. It wakes up the mind. The second thing that we did was I said, see if you can be continuous in your being with the breath. Being continuous is the antidote to doubt. Say, I can do this. Hey, look, I did one breath, two breaths, 10 breaths, not wavering. It's the developer of confidence. It's the antidote to doubt. The third thing that we did was, I said, smile. Bring up rapture in your body. Did you feel a little bit of energy in your body as you did that? You feel subtle kind of energy. It's not huge energy, but you can feel a little bit of tingling. These bodies are alive. When you sit quietly and you feel, they tingle. They vibrate. That kind of subtle feeling when you bring your mind close enough to be able to feel it is actually the antidote to the short fuse. It's the antidote to aversion or bitterness in the mind. The word for them is rapture. And often we think of rapture as falling over with rapture. You have to fall over. But if you have a sweet feeling in your body and mind, it's hard to start bringing up into the mind your aversion again. They can't last in the same mind. So it's the antidote to aversion or ill will. The fourth thing we did was we did lengthening the breath a little bit this way and this way and this way and this way. And the lengthening actually calms down the mind. That it's a first aid technique. You tell somebody, take a deep breath, take another deep breath. It calms down the mind and the body. And so for people with particularly restless minds, that's a very calming thing to do. And the last thing we did is I said, just keep yourself with the experience of this moment right now, this mind, this body, this experience. Principally, this experience. And if you can keep your mind, it's called in the text a one-pointed mind. And if you have a one-pointed mind, it's the antidote to greed and lust. You can't be thinking of, you won't be thinking about scanning the horizon. What could I find to make myself more comfortable? What could I do to make myself more comfortable? I need something to keep myself more comfortable. The mind is one-pointed and stays there. It's giving itself the message, I have everything I need. I don't need to look around. So the mind that's needy relaxes. Isn't that a neat formulation? I love that. Those five things are the five qualities of the concentrated mind. And the good thing is that you don't need to think to yourself, uh-oh, I'm a little worried about this. I'm a little anxious about that, but I'm also a little angry. What should I do? Should I do this or that? You don't have to think about that. All you have to do is take a breath and take another breath and take another breath. And by, the mind concentrates. And the concentrated mind has all those factors of calm and sustainability and clear perception and rapture and one-pointedness in it. And those are the qualities of a concentrated mind. So I'm telling you that story, first of all, because it's a good story. Second of all, because when I talked to Rose this morning, she said it was the habit of this community to do a meditation first. So I thought, oh, okay, and to do a guided meditation. So I thought, well, I'll do that guided meditation so then I can teach that about the qualities of concentration, which I like very much, and which will get me to teach about concentration and mindfulness and effort, which you may know, if you've been practicing for a while and listening to Dharma, are the three middle parts of the Eightfold Path, the Buddha's practice program for cultivating a mind that stayed unconfused, that rested in equanimity, that responded with appreciation and friendship and compassion. I'll tell you one more story about concert. Oh, well, I was going to tell you a story about a Zen master. You know that story about the tires off the car? I've told that story around in various places as I've taught. And in one place, my friend Dick Bolton, I was up in Portland, Oregon, and my friend Dick Bolton was in the audience. And everybody laughed, and then I said, who's got this, who's got that, who's got this, who's got that? We could do that here. Who would have gotten the pajamas? Who's got a lust? Or hot chocolate or a latte or something like that. Who would have gotten mad? Who would have said, I've had it? Who would have said, I'm a chronic fretter and worrier and worry about everything? And who would have said, I would have thought it's my fault? So everybody's got everything. We've covered the whole of it. So I did that, and Dick put up his hand, and he said, I don't get this, he said. I would have gone into my apartment, called the cops, made a report, and gone to work. Now, the thing is that we all would have gone into our apartments and called the cops and made a report and gone to work. Really only an exercise to see where did the mind go. We would go into the apartment and do all that stuff. Probably most of us would. But it was a great story about how to keep the mind composed under difficulty. There's a very classic Zen story about a Zen master in the samurai period in Japan. There was a notification came to his monastery that a very notorious band of samurai that were sweeping up the countryside in the direction of his town were coming near to the town, and that they destroyed everything in their wake, and that this particular samurai was tremendously ferocious and nothing frightened him. And as the samurai band came to this town, all the people in the town fled, and all the monks in the monastery fled, but the abbot did not flee. And the story goes that the head of the samurai, the warrior, came into the shrine room where the Zen master was sitting on his zafu, and he brandished his sword, And he said, aren't you frightened of me? Don't you know that I'm the sort of man that could run you through with my sword without batting an eye? And the Zen master is said to have said back to him, and I, sir, am the sort of man who could be run through with a sword without batting an eye. So it's a striking story. I heard it 30 years ago when I just started my practice. And it's a story about the concentrated mind. And the truth is, it took me about, 20 years to start to like that story. Because, maybe more. First of all, I thought it made success in practice seem too remote for me, because that wasn't going to happen to me in my lifetime. I want to do things where I think I can succeed, and I couldn't see myself doing that. So that was one. It demoralized me a little bit. And also, it seemed to me maybe that I didn't like the sense that maybe for the Zen master it was all the same to him whether he lived or died. And it more recently occurred to me that I have no idea whether it was all the same to him if he lived or died. The story doesn't say that. The story says that what he said was, if it's inevitable that I die, I can do it without batting an eye. And that's a different story. You know, when the people on those doomed planes on 9/11 knew that they were going to die, they made cell phone calls. And from a place of non-confusion, said, I'm going to die, so I love you, take good care of the children, hope everything goes good with you. They weren't relaxed, but they had clear minds and steady minds in that moment to make the phone call, to dial the number, to say that. So concentration as one of the three factors that keeps the mind steady. What I've written about in this book is that having a joyful life depends on having a clear enough mind to be able to find our own capacity to relate warmly, because that's the source of happiness. And that the three factors that restore the mind to clarity are concentration, mindfulness, and effort. So we talked a lot about concentration. I want to talk about mindfulness and effort. I like to teach about the fact that I certainly am not immune to becoming confused. I actually think that I'm going to become confused. I can't write a book about not becoming confused, because I'm still becoming confused. So I have to write a book about how to become unconfused once you become confused, because I think that's the story for us for the rest of our lives. Something happens, we get confused. Something happens to me, I get upset about it, and I stew about it, or I worry about it, or I fret about it, or I plan about it, or I do something about it, or all uncomfortable. My mind is afflicted. Here's this difficulty, da 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 da. And it goes on until I realize that actually, whatever the difficulty is, and whatever the mind state has come up, whether it's fear or fretting or dismay or disappointment or greed or envy or any afflictive mind state that's come up, that the bottom line truth about it is that I'm in pain. And I'll fret and worry and go back and forth until there's a moment when I realize that. And I say, wait a minute. And I say to my, I actually do say to myself, sweetheart, you're in pain. It's actually very important that I should say to myself, sweetheart, because then I don't hold myself responsible for it. Everybody gets confused. Sweetheart, you're in pain. That's a moment of mindfulness. Sweetheart, you're in pain. Do something about it. Take a breath. That's a moment of right effort, wise effort. I mean, do something about it. Make an effort. Take a breath. Take another breath. We'll figure out what to do. That's my three-sentence formula for retrieval. Sweetheart, you're in pain. Take a breath. Take another breath. We'll figure out something to do. The wise effort is implied. You have to watch. For me, I have to watch the moment. Find the moment of mindfulness that will rescue me out of my dilemma. I thought, because this is Washington, and I wanted to tell a mindfulness story that was in this book, I would tell the story of leaving Washington 5 years ago, 6 years ago. It was 2002 that I was here the last time. It was just post 2001. There was drums of war before the Afghanistan invasion. The news every day was worse. I got on the train, the metro line, leaving Washington for New York the day after I was here. And I'd bought several morning newspapers, which I hoped to read on the way to New York. And I sat down, and a young woman sat down next to me. And I looked at her. I was appreciating her as she sat down. She looked 30-ish, and she was tremendously well-dressed. She looked beautiful. She had a beautiful red suit and coiffed and made up and just so well put together. She had an attaché case that looked wonderful, so she was going to work, and I imagine she had some really interesting and exciting job. And everybody else around me was clicking away on their computers as we were pulling out of the station. And I was feeling really tired. It had been a long trip. I'd been at Washington, it had been the end of my trip. I'm going back to New York, and I got on the train, and I saw everybody clicking away, and here's this beautiful, bright-looking young woman. And I was feeling particularly old and tired, and I began to tell myself stories like, why am I doing this, schlepping myself around? I'm too old. You shouldn't be here. This has been too hard. Look at all these people typing away, completely excited about their work, and they're probably not at all thinking about the world is falling apart at the seams, and they're just interested in themselves. And I sit down and I start to read the newspaper, and I realize I was overwhelmed by a wave of sleepiness. So I said to this young woman next to me, listen, I really need to take a nap. Would you wake me 20 minutes before Penn Station, because I really want some time to put myself together before we get off? So she said, yes, of course. And then she leaned over to me, and she had a furrowed brow like she was concerned. And she said, are you all right? And I said, yes, are you? And she said, no, I'm not. And did that surprise you? It did me, and a big zap of energy went through me when she said it. No, I'm not. So, and I woke right up. You know, because, you know, when somebody says, no, I'm not, you wake right up. And all the tiredness goes out. Because actually we have good hearts. Somebody says, I'm in trouble. You wake right up. I said, you want to talk? She said, yeah. She said, listen, I read that same newspaper that you're reading now that I'd opened. She said, I read it before I had left home this morning. And I'm really very worried about what's going on in the world, and I'm really worried about the possibility of war, and I have two young children, and I'm worried about them growing up in this world. And Washington is just such a tense place all the time, and there's all this stuff going on. Of course, these last few days have been terrible with the sniper, and I'm just generally worried. And so we talked politics for a long time. And we talked about, she was certainly very au courant and knew a great deal about the political situation, very informed, and we had a great and lively conversation, and my whole sleepiness was gone. You pay attention for a minute and your sleepiness is gone. And we finished that whole conversation, during which I was also thinking to myself, look what you did, Sylvia. You underestimated. You looked at this woman, you looked at how beautiful she was, and you immediately assumed that she, unlike you, is not thinking about the world situation, does not have concerns about the future of the world, that she's only interested in her own self and her business and her attaché case and whatever. And I realized that it was reverse ageism. I felt very embarrassed about it. I really don't like it when I get on a bus and three people stand up. I don't like that ageism, but here I had done it in reverse. I don't like it the other way either. So I'm feeling embarrassed about myself, but I was enjoying the conversation so much, and she was so pleasant. So we talked all about that, and we finished talking about the world situation. And I thought she'd want, she said to me, oh, do you want to take your nap now? I said, no, I'm wide awake. She said, well, then I'd like to really tell you that I'm also worried about what I'm doing in New York today, because I actually work in Washington, but my firm is in New York, and I have to take the work I've been doing and do a presentation, and I'm not sure it's going to be good enough, and I really need my job because my husband's job is precarious. And I realized that everyone is worried about the world, and everybody is worried about themselves. So we have two television screens playing the world and my life, and we're all worried about both of them. And it's right that we do that. That's what keeps the species alive. I have to worry about my world, and so do you, so that we take care of it. That's what keeps the species going. And I have to worry about this and be concerned about it as well. First of all, because I and you and everybody else will be the cause of change in the world and peace on earth if it ever happens. So I need to know what's happening there. I also need to know it because if I see it and feel it, I can relate to it. If I can relate to it, it pulls me out of the spiraling down rabbit hole of my own self-absorbed woe. And so I realized, talking to this woman, we talked about her work. I said, do you want to tell me about it? She told me about her work, and it was very complicated. I didn't quite get exactly what she did. But it didn't matter that I got it. It mattered to her that I listened to her about what she had to do. And I knew that. And we talked all the way to New York. And when I got off the train, I felt completely uplifted in my spirit, because I realized that what happens is I had pulled myself, she had, by being there and by responding to me and by giving me the call, the cue, no, I'm not all right. We are none of us all right. Really, we're none of us all right. We're all right enough to have been to be here, but we've got this and that and the other, sometimes worse, sometimes better. And if we say to each other, this is my story, and other people are interested, we're lifted up, we're connected, it's a completely different experience. I got off the train and I realized that I had never asked her name, nor had she asked mine. And that was the least important thing about either of us. I didn't need to know her name. Was completely uplifted, and it was in the winter time, because the public address system in Penn Station was playing the song from the Messiah, I Know That My Redeemer Liveth. And I thought to myself, my Redeemer is always the person who's next to me, wherever I am. That person is the possible foil for me to pull myself out of me and remember that there's a world that I'm connected to. That person has a story. If I'm interested in that person's story, they'll be interested in mine, and neither of us will be alone. And we will be engaged in what's the best of human occupations, which is empathic communication. And we'll be alive. And I had to pay enough attention. I had to be mindful in that moment. It's almost 9. I don't think I can tell you the story I was going to tell you about effort. You want to hear the story about effort? I'll talk fast. It's a fun story. Because effort, and I really want to tell you about the three, because this is a book about effort and mindfulness and concentration. Effort is the unsung hero of the Eightfold Path, I think. We always talk about mindfulness and concentration. We don't talk, in my view, enough about effort. But every time that we decide, now I am going to pay attention, now I am going to concentrate. Effort means the moment in the mind where you say, I'm going to do something else and I'm going to choose differently. Run, run, run. It's like the Nike ad that says, just do it. You see your mind on the road to unhappiness and you say, take that other road, it's a better road. I got a $270 fine for driving in the carpool lane in the twilight of a rainy February day. It was dark. I didn't notice there were those diamonds in the line. They had just put in that carpool line. Those are all my excuses. And I was on the phone. I was on the phone with one of my daughters who called because she was upset. And I was trying to watch the traffic, trying to ride in the rain. And all of a sudden, I realize I'm in the carpool lane. And I say, I need to hang up now. I'm in the carpool lane. I have to get out of it when I see flashing lights behind me. I pull over to the side of the highway. Policeman says, I say to him, please, 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 officer. I did not, it's a new carpool lane. I didn't know, it was a new carpool lane. I didn't know it was there. I was talking to my daughter. I shouldn't have said that on the telephone. It was an urgent communication. I was trying to concentrate. And when I realized, before I saw you, I was trying to get out of the... He said, I need to see your license and registration. I gave it to him. He went back to his motorcycle. And I see him making a phone call. I thought, great, he's going to see my record. He's going to see it's clean. He's going to let me off with a warning, maybe. Came back. He wrote me a ticket. Gave me a ticket. And he said, it's all right. It's not a moving violation, so which is worse on you. But anyway, it's a $270 ticket. And... thank you very much. Then he goes back to his motorcycle. He says, drive carefully as you get back in the traffic. And I'm thinking, where were you 10 minutes ago when that little green Corvette was whizzing at 80 miles an hour through the traffic back and forth? I was mad. So I drive into the traffic. And the phone rings, the same daughter calling again. So what happened? I got a ticket. Oh, it's my fault. I said, don't feel bad. What happened? Happened. I'll be more careful the next time. I'm hanging up now. I hang up and driving along, and I am free now from the constraints of behaving myself. What happened? Happened. To go back and fume again about it. So I fume about that. Then I go back to the fume right before that, and I start to think about if only that meeting at Spirit Rock hadn't gone on so long. Why do people belabor a point so long? If it had ended earlier, it would have been before the carpool lane, and it would have been in the light, and I would have seen the carpool lane. So I'm going reviewing the irritations of the day and whizzing myself up. And the last couple of miles to my house are down a lane, and it's really beautiful in there. Normally, it's a narrow country lane, and I usually enjoy it, but here I am. I'm rehearsing at this point how I'm going to tell this story to my husband when I get home. So I'm thinking, I'm trying out opening lines. You can't believe what a horrible day I had. Car phones are a menace. Where are the cops when you need them? And I have different lines to see what's a good opening line. And at that moment, there's a jackrabbit leaps out from the hill at the just... ahead of me, leaps out and flies in a miraculous arc over the front of my car and lands on the other side in the grass. So first, my heart stops. You know, I thought I was going to hit the jackrabbit. Sails in this amazing arc over my car and into the grass. It was amazing. It was beautiful. It was an amazing feat. So then I thought to myself, after I relaxed from that, I was very happy I hadn't hit the jackrabbit. I felt my mind now going back to pick up the story of the rehearsal of my day of woe. And I realized that I also had the jackrabbit story that I could tell. But you know, in television news and radio news, you know, the conventional wisdom is start with trouble because it catches the attention, you know. But I realized I could tell the jackrabbit story. It's an amazing, it's a miracle. Or I could tell this other story. And I could watch my mind, like at a junction of the road, I could go happiness or unhappiness. Where do you want to go, you know? Like there's a question about that, you know. So actually I got home and I realized by the time I got home that part of the reason that I was rehearsing this tale of woe was I didn't want to get scolded for the $270 ticket, and I was embarrassed about it, and I was tired, and I was hungry, and I felt foolish about it. And so I told the story straight. I something like, hello, I just saw the most amazing jackrabbit, and I got a $270 parking ticket, and I feel humiliated about it, and I'm tired, and I'm hungry, and let's fix dinner. And we did. The story would be different if I, you know, it's a relatively easy choice, happiness and not happiness. The story would be different if I had hit the jackrabbit, or if I'd had another 20 miles to drive, or if I had really thought that Seymour was going to be mad at me. And, you know, he teased me, but he wouldn't really be mad at me. The story would be different, but it wasn't different. It was like that. What was different was that I could catch my mind and put it in the direction of happiness. And, it's not a big deal. Two people sat down and had a nice dinner together. But that's worth a lot in a life. So that's what I really wanted to talk to you about cultivating effort and mindfulness and concentration, because they clear the mind so that we make wise decisions, so that we can relate to ourselves and to other people with friendliness. That's it.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.